Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
We're going from an era of abundance driven by a huge capital boom 10 years prior in the shales that led to low prices, that led to a lack of capital, which is now having a supply response. That's the commodity cycle. And I think we're in the process of inflecting towards a major bull move.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special edition of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and today we're going to be talking about oil, other things related to the strait being closed, and we're going to be talking about it with Adam Rosenzweig of Gehring & Rosenzweig, the natural resources investors. Obviously, always a very compelling, action-packed, data-rich conversation, but it's more important than ever because I believe, and we'll see what Adam thinks about this, that our markets are not yet pricing in the greatest energy shock in all of history. So, Adam, welcome back.
Yeah, wonderful to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm doing really well, but I have to confess I have a little disorientation around how I'm watching the markets behave compared to what even Fatih Birol of the IEA said, that this crisis is larger than 73, 81, and 2022 all combined. What's your assessment?
I think that's certainly correct. When you look at the physical volumes that we're talking about here that are being disrupted, I mean, they're really larger than anything we've seen before. So I think in that regard, absolutely correct. And I think that the question we get asked over and over again is simply, you know, how can the market be so asleep at this level? You know, indices are making all-time highs. Inflationary pressures now, just this week, we've seen some readings that we might be getting rate hikes at some point to address the likely forthcoming scary inflation prints. But I mean, quite frankly, given how inflation works formulaically with a lag, I think anybody that was watching this market knew that that was on the horizon the minute that the strait closed. And particularly now that it's been closed for this long, I think the market in general, energy markets in particular, are about as complacent as I can remember in the face of a massive shock.
Yeah, I think the March PCE personal consumption expenditure came in at 0.7, which if you analyze it, if you could, it's 8% inflation. That's not consistent with cutting rates, obviously. But I guess the story is, the narrative is, well, this will all be over soon. So I do want to dive into that because Goldman Sachs put out an analysis and said, well, you know, we get back up to 70% after 3 months of the strait being reopened. And then next 3 months, we get up to 88%. But if you run the math, still missing 88% of 25 million barrels per day of oil and products is still a 2.9 million barrel shortfall after 6 months. That's astonishing.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think the math that the market is doing, which we've long disagreed with. We disagreed with it in January before the strait was closed. But I think the math that the market is doing is basically the following. If you believed the headline numbers back in January, we were in a 2 million barrel a day surplus last year, going to a 3 million barrel a day surplus this year. The Strait of Hormuz, as we now all know, we've all come up to speed very quickly. I will admit I knew this long before, but the rest of the world. It sort of reminds me of those COVID charts that everyone became an expert in very, very quickly, exponential growth very fast. The funniest of which was the chart of Googling exponential growth, which itself was an exponential growth chart. And so now it's the Strait of Hormuz. But as we all now know, 20 million barrels a day transited through that strait before February 28th. Some amount of oil is getting out via the Red Sea and the East-West bypass pipeline, probably one of the most sensitive and strategic assets in the world right now, I suspect, and some getting out through Iraq via Turkey and some through the UAE via Turkey. And then some was getting out from Iranian production itself, now subject, of course, to the U.S. blockade of the strait. So we're impacting somewhere between 10 and 12 million barrels. That seems to be people's best guess. And, you know, to a certain extent, it is a little bit of a guess, but it's certainly not less than that. And so if you're at 10 to 12 million barrels a day times 8 weeks and counting, you're talking about a billion barrels or so, or certainly on our way to a billion barrels of oil that's just lost from the market. Now, it's not lost forever. The strait, of course, will reopen. Oil will flow again. That's not the last time we've ever used the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf. However, and when you turn the taps back on, you're not going to make up that difference. What essentially you're going to do, to simplify things a lot, is you're going to, you know, extend the life of these fields by 6 weeks. You know, so sometime in the future, they'll go on about a month longer than they ought to have, more or less. And so I think what the market is kind of saying is that things will get back on a daily flows rate, largely to where they were in January. Once the situation resolves itself, we'll have blown a hole of about a billion barrels in global storage, and we'll be back on track to 3 million barrel per day surplus, which means that in 300 odd days, we'll be refilled the inventories to where we were. And so, you know, maybe it's not January 27 anymore, but second quarter 27, everything's back to normal. And, you know, maybe geopolitical premiums have gone up a bit. So instead of $50, you're talking 60, 65 on the long end of the curve. And that's sort of where everything is settled out right now. The problem with that math, though, is that we never believed we had a surplus. In fact, you had a 2 million barrel per day surplus, alleged surplus last year, which means over the course of the year, we should have built inventories by about 730 million barrels. And of course, we didn't build them by anything or next to nothing. And so we've always been of the belief that, in fact, we were pretty well balanced last year. And we were pretty well balanced despite the fact that OPEC was producing an extra 2.5 million, or the quota's up 2.5 million, production up about 2 million barrels a day over the course of the year. All of it absorbed. So we actually repositioned the portfolio in January with much more of an oil focus. The idea being you were offered very, very low nominal prices for crude, near record low real prices for crude, and absolute record low prices for crude relative to gold, predicated on this horrible surplus that we didn't believe was actually true. So that's why we liked it. And today, I think all you've done with the closure of the strait is you've lit the fuse on this bull market. You have taken inventories down sharply to what is now, I can only describe as what will be dangerously low levels. And by the way, we haven't even seen that begin to happen yet, because we're more or less still discharging tankers that were filled, you know, just before the closure of the strait. That's now behind us. And so now the apparent shortfall is really going to make itself felt physically. So inventories are going to come down. The strait's going to reopen. Everyone is going to say, okay, let's track how quickly these inventories fill back up again. And I just fear that they're not going to. And that's when the speculative energy comes into the space. That's when the long end of the curve lifts up. And it might stay backwardated because it's a tight market, but the whole curve will lift up. And I think you need to put $100 on the long end of the curve to incentivize companies to raise capital and start developing new projects again. None of that's going to happen while the strait is closed, because everyone's reacting today. The spot price will move up and down on tweets and news flow. Any piece of data that comes out will effectively be thrown in the trash bin and written off as, essentially extraordinary and one time in nature. You know, so if you got a big IEA report, for instance, that showed the world was all amok. Well, I mean, I think everyone says, yeah, fine, that's happening now. Let's look forward. Let's look through this. And I think it takes the strait reopening and that not playing out, that refilling of inventories, to really get people going in this market.
Well, it indeed, so much to unpack there. I heard that Trump just recently said that Exxon and Chevron refused to pump more oil. And they're, of course, looking out on the long end of the curve and seeing $70 oil. That's not going to get them out of their seats to pump more oil. That's just the reality of it, right?
No, I think that's absolutely right. You know, people have said, why don't the shale guys get working again? And I know we're going to talk about shale in a second. And shale is short cycle, right? So it can be brought online relatively quickly. But these companies don't have a good inventory of tier one wells anymore. They've drilled them all. And so they're suffering depletion. Doesn't mean they won't increase their activity, but it means that we won't get the same response that we're used to getting. And you're certainly not going to get it at $70 crude on the longer end of the curve, which is essentially where they need to hedge it out in order to, you know, set their drilling budgets and pay their crews and, you know, have good working capital needs for their counterparties. So no, it just doesn't work at these prices, and it needs to lift materially higher. And the Exxons and the Chevrons of the world, if you're not talking about shale, I mean, they need much, much higher prices. You know, I think we've all been sort of lulled, right, into this sense of easy oil because of how prolific the shales have been. And I just want to kind of throw some numbers quickly at you. You know, the shales grew their production by 13 million barrels over 10 or 12 or 15 years. Depends where you want to start the point. Unbelievable. I mean, Saudi took them decades to get up to 10 million barrels a day. And I think the most interesting example is when you're talking about, you know, Venezuela and what's going to happen there. And, you know, in the best case scenario, they're going to add 1 million barrels per day in the next 3 to 5 years at a cost of somewhere between $100 to $150 billion. You know, it's $100,000 flowing barrel oil. The Emiratis are the same. They, of course, left OPEC this week. And with that, people have been saying, well, yeah, they want to increase their production because they spent $150 billion over the last several years, and they have 1 million barrels of spare capacity to show for it. I mean, my God, is that expensive oil? And that's now becoming the marginal barrel. So that's where the market ultimately should price, and you need $100 oil to make that work at a minimum.
Mm-hmm, indeed. So here's where we're going to discuss here today when the Strait closed, which is your most recent quarterly output. I think it came out March 12th. So obviously a lot has happened since then. People can find it at GoRosen.com. But I guess I want to start here, Adam. This is today. So we're recording this on May 1st. And we had very typical Friday. Some news came out. It was a sort of an unconfirmed report that Pakistan had received a courier that was Iran's latest proposal for ceasefire negotiations. And so next thing you know, we're just watching like massive amounts of oil get sold and dumped off. And I just want to contrast that very quickly. I know you can do this better than anybody. Seeing this behavior, I'm so old, I remember 2022. So here we had this attack of Ukraine by Russia. And what I've indicated in yellow is 5 months where oil spiked just on the idea that some Russian oil would get sanctioned. We hadn't even gotten to the point where we're seeing today the actual destruction of physical Russian oil export assets. And that was a market response to something that was a fraction of the size of what we're actually experiencing today. How do you make sense of that?
Oh, you know, I think that in general, people just have not been paying attention to the energy markets. I think back in 2020, with COVID and oil prices went negative, perhaps we were slightly more fragile across the energy spectrum because, you know, that was obviously a huge shock to the system, a huge bearish shock. And then you followed that up almost immediately, right, with demand that picked up faster than anyone expected. And then the threat of Russian volumes coming off the market. Perhaps that explains why you got a bigger response then. I mean, look, you are getting a response in the spot price today. Yes, you picked today's chart to look at and showing news flow and it's trading down, etc. But, you know, in general, we have seen dated Brent, you know, trade up to an all-time high at 145. So the physical traders do know that there's a problem here, but it's just not translated into the long end of the curve, and it's not traded in, priced in to the stocks, and it's not priced into the broad market. And I think that the magnitude of today versus 2022 is night and day. As you mentioned, 2022 was done with a bit of fear about what could happen. Ultimately, Russian volumes were not really impaired and taken off the market. They maybe went underground a little bit and became sanctioned and harder to track, but we didn't lose material Russian supply. Today, we're seeing, you know, on the order of 10 plus million barrels of real disruption. I mean, you can track it. You can see that oil's not going out. And that's just a very, very different situation. So it reminds me a little bit of what we saw in the gold market back in 2022-2023. Excuse me. When inflation pressures were high, central banks started to step in, and the stocks didn't really move, and you didn't have any speculative energy in gold quite yet. And we told people, well, it might sound sort of foolish, just wait a little bit. Just wait for this to work itself through. You're going to realize it one way or another. You can either benefit from it or respond to it later.
There is a ticking clock in this, and so we've talked as if the strait opens up relatively soon. And maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But the ticking clock for me was contained in this chart by J.P. Morgan's commodities research and combining some sources. But what we're looking at here is OECD commercial crude inventories and then expressing it in terms of days of inventories. And it turns, the JPM forecast said, wow, they could see us getting back to the bad old days of 2008, you know, where again, you know, there was no super crisis at that point because this is before the GFC got kicked off. But, you know, the 5 out of 6 quarters, there was like slightly less supply than demand. And that was enough to spike oil then to 147 a barrel today, whatever that is, 220 something. But they're forecasting we're going to get there and exceed that already. And if the strait stays closed for another month or two, we'll exceed that by a lot. Do you square up with this? I mean, is this an important chart for people to...
Absolutely. Look, this is a major, major, major problem. I want to be really emphatic. You know, perhaps I'm talking calmly and slowly on a quiet Friday here in May, but this is a major problem. And this doesn't resolve itself perfectly. I mean, as everyone knows, if the strait opens tomorrow, the same way that we're receiving cargoes now that were loaded 6+ weeks ago, if the strait opens tomorrow, that oil won't reach the terminals for 6 weeks from the day you start loading it. These tankers go 3,000+ nautical miles basically at the speed of a bicycle, you know, so it takes a long time to move this stuff around the world. The damage is absolutely catastrophic. Do we have oil in inventory? Yeah, we have some. You know, we obviously have 4 billion barrels or so in OECD inventories. That's commercial plus strategic. We're releasing 400, you know, basically a third of the global strategic oil reserves into the market. But I can bet you anything countries will have learned after this, you probably want to refill those again. A huge part of the global oil inventory is not really sort of sitting there available for use. It's in pipelines and sitting at refinery gate storage tanks, things of that nature. It's more working capital than true inventory. It's more like your, again, working capital than your checking account, if you will. And so this is a major, major problem. And I think what's really interesting, particularly for markets and particularly for those of us sitting in North America, we've heard a lot that because of the shale's resilience, et cetera, the United States is in a much better position than they would have been in years past, where they were much more dependent on international Middle Eastern oil. And there's some truth to that from a physical side. But it doesn't help us with price because, of course, oil is a global commodity. Unlike gas that has big infrastructure bottlenecks that might stop, you know, might dislocate U.S. gas from world prices, with crude oil, the whole system has to stay in a relatively tight band because push comes to shove. You buy it in the cheaper area and ship it off to the area where it's more expensive, right? And so we're seeing that here in the United States. Prices are high and going higher, but we have the physical oil. And I think to put it in perspective, particularly for the North American viewers or listeners, I got back from Europe last week and they're worried. And I think all you have to do is look at the behavior of United Airlines and Lufthansa. Both of them are subject to the same crisis in Iran. Both of them appreciate that prices are going up. But for United, they feel confident they can get the jet fuel. So what did they do? They increased the price of their tickets over the summer months by 30%, and I suspect we'll see them go up more. What did Lufthansa do? They canceled 20,000 flights. It's not a question of price. They don't think that they can get the physical availability. Furthermore, I think because of the physical dislocations here, we could see a massive, massive potential spike in spot oil. I don't know that, or rather, I I'm fairly confident that it won't be a sustained move, but could you get oil up over $200 on a spike? Very, very easily, because we're going to get in some ways the potential of an inversion of what happened in the spring of 2020. You might remember back then oil went negative, and the reason it went negative was a quirk in the future contract where essentially, right, if you were holding the long contract on the day of expiry, you had to receive delivery of that crude. Now, we didn't have any room in the storage tanks, and so the person who was holding that long tried desperately to find the other side of the contract and get rid of it, essentially. And eventually they were able to, but at a very dear price, where not only did they give the oil away for free, but they had to pay someone $47 in order to for the privilege of taking their oil, right? I think we could end up in a very similar but offsetting situation where if you're short oil on NYMEX, let's say, you have to come up with the oil to deliver. And if you're starting to get worried about physical levels here, we're talking about physical levels, you could go into expiry, and is it May, is it June? I don't know. You could go into a physical expiry where you're like, get me out. I just need out of my short, and you could see a massive squeeze higher. So we're in that black swan tail area right now, in my estimation, where things are so badly muddled and mucked up that we could start to see some very, very, very strange things indeed. This time, though, unlike 2020, I think it will be on the bullish side. And unlike 2022, which really did sort of react to geopolitics and then settled down once those geopolitics settled, I think what we're going to see here is a catalyst for people to begin looking at the space again. And they're going to be sort of forced to realize that we're not rebuilding those inventories. They're going to stare at you every day. They're going to be awfully low. There's going to be incremental bid in the market from the strategic reserves to refill those, and it's going to be awfully difficult to get the commercial sector back to a comfortable level.
Well, this could be the opposite of the old axiom, which is buy the rumor, sell the news. They've been selling the news, selling the rumor for oil, but they're going to have to buy the news, which is once the strait reopens, then we're going to settle down and we're going to go, how much is actually missing? How long could this take? And that's when I think, the reality will sort of come in. So I want to turn now, I got to talk about, okay, where's this oil going to come from? Trump, I'm going to be very kind, could use some refinement in his understanding of oil, because he came out and said that we're going to double our output next year in the U.S. So I want to sort of explore that for a bit. And you do this in your report beautifully that there's OPEC and then there's not OPEC. Those are the two big camps in here. And so it turns out that comparing the rest of not OPEC, non-OPEC, to shale, it's been a shale story since 2009. I mean, there's basically no change here. It's been a story of shale. So, okay, let's dial in on shale very quickly because it's that important. When we do, we find out that the rest of U.S. shale since 2019 is basically down 1 million barrels a day. And more than 100% of our growth then is due to shale from the Permian, shale oil from the Permian, making up that loss and then some. But then here's the killer. We see that the year-on-year growth expressed on a monthly basis, that if you were back here in 2018, in that month, there would have been around 1 million barrels more coming out of the ground than the similar month a year prior. And here's the COVID hole. But otherwise, this wedge says that the Permian's growth, its best days are behind it. Where is this oil growth going to come from that Trump's talking about?
Well, look, I think that's really the big question, isn't it? And, we for a long time have argued that we feel that the shales are sort of past their sell-by date. It doesn't mean they're going to collapse to zero, but it means that the days of 1 million, 1.5 million barrels per day per year growth is about, clearly behind us. And I don't think you will. And, I think you have to go back to 1971, where we found ourselves in a similar situation. The U.S. conventional production had grown forever, absolutely forever. And then in 1971, it unexpectedly rolled over. And you had the first Arab oil crisis shortly thereafter. Talk about history rhyming. And Nixon got on and he said, we're going to launch Project Independence. And this will never happen again because we have this rich, powerful bounty in this country and we're going to exploit it for our independence. Yeah. And so we did a few things, including made it easier to permit for rigs, for wells, and offered a few tax advantages, although I think in general the tax advantages to the oil industry that everyone sort of talks about. I don't really know what they're talking about. If you want tax advantages, you should go into real estate, not into oil and gas. You get some accelerated depreciation, but that's about it. And ironically, the other thing you look to do is actually to lift some price caps on different energy sources, because back then it was a question of availability, not of price. Right. Today, now we might go into the availability physicality side of it, but in general, everyone's worried about the price at the pump. No one's worried about gas lines. So raising prices then was actually seen to help, because you were going to incentivize the companies to drill. And drill they did. They quadrupled their rig count. They really got after it in a very material way. Quadrupled, or just think about that. You know, massive, massive increase in mobilization of efforts and capital. And production continued to fall by 30% by the time the decade was out. It wasn't because they weren't drilling wells, just the wells weren't as good as the ones they had drilled before. And so you lose the declines on this big, big base of highly productive wells, and you start drilling to replace that with far less productive wells, and it becomes a treadmill that eventually throws you off, and production rolls over under its own weight. And I think that we're in that kind of, potentially in that kind of a situation right now. So, you know, I will say that since we last spoke, they've revised up some of the shale numbers, but really all that that has done is it sort of changed the whole, that when you showed the year-on-year growth that was slowing over time, it kind of changed the whole chart. It didn't change the trajectory, which continues to be very, very fast slowing of year-on-year growth. So the second derivative of production. And I think it means that if we haven't gone negative already, we'll be negative year on year within a month or two. So I don't think that you're able to do that, to buck that trend. And I think that it's going to be very, very difficult to find these incremental barrels. That's what makes this story so bullish, is that I don't really know where it comes from.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the EIA in their short-term outlook in January, so they put this out monthly. I scan it every time. And here they were saying, this little black bar would be, is, you know, we're going to lose some production, but we're going to gain some production. The black bar is the sum of that. So in 2024, we put on about, I'll call that maybe 300,000 barrels a day. And then the next year it was, oh, they told me 300,000, then 400,000. But then we're going to be kind of flat for 2026. And they're like, you add it all up, we're going to be down 300,000 barrels by 2027. That was then, after the war kicks out. This is from their April. And next thing you know, we're putting on, we're not down 300,000, we're up 400,000. That's a 700,000 barrel swing in just a couple of months. What could they be looking at?
Hope? Look, I just don't see it. You know, when you look at sort of the headline numbers, it's very difficult to make projections on production just looking at the summary statistics. It really pays to dig deeper, look at the wells, see how the wells are producing, try to project what they call type curves or production profiles for the wells. And then even then, it's quite difficult to wrap it all up. And so what you need to then do a little bit farther is study what is driving productivity. Has productivity changed either in barrels per foot of lateral or just barrels per well, however you want to look at it, and try to begin to understand, you know, what of those drivers could potentially be leading to a change in production rate. And what I suspect the EIA is looking at for next year is a major uptick in drilling without appreciating that an uptick in drilling will have a nearly equal but offsetting decline in per well productivity. So very much like the 1970s, you'll get the industry mobilized again, unfortunately, probably on the back of higher prices, not what the consumer wants to hear, not what the Fed wants to hear. That's the only way you're going to get the industry active again. And then it's going to risk disappointment because what you bring on is not going to be as productive as what you were drilling yesterday and not as productive as what you're drilling today, both because we're just going to less productivity areas. And then if you accelerate the development, then it could really fall off a cliff quite quickly. So I see that as very, very difficult to see how they arrest declines, and like you said, see a 700,000 barrel swing from their projection last month to this month. I mean, if you think about it, right, they had a model that suggested a decline. Now they see an incremental improvement of 700,000 from that number. That's the same as saying they're going to bring on 700,000 barrels more than they were expecting to last month. I don't know where you do that. 700,000 would be one of the best shale growth years ever. And that's just what they're saying has changed incrementally from last month to this month for their projection. So I just simply put, I don't see it. I just don't see it. I think instead, if you threw a lot at this, maybe you get it back to flat.
Well, and as a side point, they didn't even model in that most recent report a big price increase for a barrel of oil. But what difference would it really make? Because remember, 2022, we had big price increases and didn't really meaningfully change the trajectory of this line.
Well, that's what we call the paradox of depletion, because of course the oil industry is an economic industry. Of course, price matters, but at the same time, you see moments in time where production is challenged, where the incremental barrel becomes harder to find and prices rally 10x, you know, and you could have said from 1999 to 2014, when price went from $11 to $100 and then stayed there for 5 years, you had economic incentives. The problem was the North Sea and Cantarell, which were your big growth drivers through the 80s and 90s, were rolling over. In the 1970s, again, oil went up 14x and stayed there for a number of years. You had a huge economic incentive to get to work, and get to work people did. U.S. production fell over that period of time. Why? Because the big growth driver, conventional, was slowing. So, you know, the paradox is that there's still resource left underground the day that the per day flow rate hits its maximum and rolls over. That's ultimately the paradox. You would think that with all that oil left in the ground, all that copper, mind you, if you're looking at copper mines, whatever it's going to be, you do not hit your maximum daily flow rate when that reserve exhausts itself. You hit the maximum daily flow rate with, in some cases, 50 or 60% of your resource still undeveloped yet. That's the paradox. And so people say, well, let's get after it faster. But you can't. Once you're past that level, it's very difficult to go on to make new highs. And so our contention is you're past that level in most of the shales. So absent finding a new field, I don't see that changing. Now, could you find a new shale field in the United States? I think that is highly, highly unlikely. And the reason is, we've known where the shale fields have been for 50 or 60 years at this point. We lacked the technology to extract them, which is why when that part of the puzzle clicked 15 or so years ago, we really got to work in a hurry and we developed, you know, 13 million barrels and 95 billion cubic feet per day of gas of shale resource, because we knew where they all were. The flip side to that, the other side of the coin, the darker side, is that we don't have anything that's undiscovered in shale, because we've mapped every inch of shale in the United States and we've developed it already.
Well, indeed. And maybe you can shed some light on this as a closing piece on the oil story. So I'm having trouble trying to assess how bad the damage is in the Gulf, because the United States politely asked satellite photo companies not to take any photos and distribute them. And I haven't seen any. I don't know if you have access to anything. I really don't have a sense of how bad things are damaged over there. And I won't know, but here's my rule of thumb. No news is bad news. So they're hiding it from me because it's probably not good news, is my beginning bid on that story. What do you make of that?
Look, you know, I'm hearing stories of hedge funds that are sending their young analysts in dinghies through the Strait of Hormuz with big binoculars, and I suspect they're reporting back absolute nonsense, which then gets packaged quite nicely into their monthly investor reports and things of that nature. The truth is, we have no idea, and we'll know when we know. The truth is also, frankly, that, you know, damaged infrastructure gets repaired. I, in general, prefer not to trade on geopolitical noise like that. And sometimes it's to my detriment, because sometimes it takes quite a while to get repaired. But in my mind, those things are ultimately transitory and temporary, unlike inflation. sometimes very disruptive, sometimes for long times, but I prefer to look at supply demand, you know, depletion problems, geological issues, and underlying currents of demand that are a little bit easier to predict longer term than things of that nature. But having said that, you know, it's all but guaranteed that when the Strait does reopen, like you said, it will take several months to bring it back up to its full production. And the problem here is that we're on our back foot. You know, the inventories will be quite low. And so we're going to need things in a hurry. So I think it's just going to make the level of acuteness more and potentially a little bit longer. Ultimately, this bull market in crude, whenever it has started, we can debate whether it started yet or not. I think it most certainly has. But ultimately, the driver of this crude bull market is the fact that we've underinvested in it, in the industry, for so long. We just don't have that next generation of projects ready to go once the shales start to decline, and the shales are now slowing sharply, and they might have already started to decline already. And we just don't have it. I mean, it's not waiting there, that next big generation of offshore projects, of oil sands projects, what have you. We need to bring in, you know, we've been spending about $500 billion per year as an industry upstream. By my estimations, we need to be spending about $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion in order for a number of years in order to right the ship. And you do that through economic incentives, meaning higher prices and good profitability and good stock performance. So this bull market is going to far outlast the repairs of the Strait of Hormuz, of the infrastructure. These things are all catalysts. They're accelerants to this bull market. It's what is going to force people to pay attention. And then I think we're in it for a number of years until we've recapitalized the industry.
Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing. My support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. For everybody listening, we're talking with Adam Rosenzweig of Gehring and Rosenzweig and discussing their most recent quarterly report. And now, can we talk natural gas for just a sec? Hey, here's, you know, 2022, again, that famous period. We saw natural gas 6, 7, 8, 9, even touching 10 briefly. This is weather in the yellow here. This is the behavior of natural gas in the U.S. since the war started, which is here in March. It's down. So not much going on there. And, of course, we can see just nothing but lots of demand. These are in billions of cubic feet per day. And this is, again, from your report pulled from the EIA. Look at all these LNG plants coming online. It's about 13 BCF by 2030 additional. So it's about 4 BCF per year, give or take. So just holding that four number in line, and I read stuff like this every day. So, Gaurab Chakrabarty was pointing out that Chevron is now going to sell natural gas, not to chemical plants. They're building a five gigawatt. That's like five Denvers of demand, 5 gigawatt gas power plant for Microsoft. So I ran the numbers and it turns out that one plant for Microsoft is going to consume about 0.75% of current daily marketed dry gas production. It's about somewhere in the vicinity of 0.8. BCF per day. And there's data centers going in all over the place. So we have LNG terminals. We've got this demand. My question is anybody adding this up? Because it feels like there's a problem here. And when you point out where our shale gas growth has been since 2023, it's, again, the Permian more than making up for all other shales. And actually, when you sum them, you get to pretty close to flat on the past year, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And, you know, the Permian is going through what we call this gas burp, which means is the Permian, you know, the Permian's a not purely unique, but a little bit different in terms of a gas field. It produces oil and gas commingled together. And as the well, any given well in the Permian gets older, it's going to produce more gas relative to oil compared to how it started out. It's going to get gassier. And eventually the pressure lessens so much that the gas and the oil actually separate like a can of soda after you've opened it or a bottle of beer. And, you know, the gas, when it's sealed under pressure, the gas is dissolved in the liquid, and when you release the pressure, they begin to separate and one flows. And so eventually, as these wells get older and the pressure comes down, you flow gas preferentially towards the end. It gets gassier. Now, when the Permian was growing, its wells, on average, were getting younger. The production-weighted average age of a well was getting younger as you drilled more and more and more. That's now begun to change because the field and on its oil side of things has basically kind of plateaued, right? And it looks like it's turning negative year on year, which means the wells are getting older and older and gassier. So you get this big kind of gas rush out of the Permian. Is that meaningful, impactful? I mean, it is, but it's also a bit of a swan song. It's telling you the field's getting awfully old, and most importantly, it does not go on forever. And so when does it actually start to roll over entirely? Is it this year or next year? My guess is probably the end of this year, beginning part of next year, and take that with a grain of salt because I can tend to be a little bit early on things. So I think the Permian is going to sort of have this wake-up moment within the next 2 years, let's say that for certain. In the meantime, the rest of the shales are all declining, you know, relatively sharply. Even the Marcellus has been now flat for about 3 years, and we're going gangbusters on our exports. Absolutely gangbusters. So what gives? Why are prices stuck where they are today? 20% of LNG is now also trapped in the Strait of Hormuz, and we're having major problems with gas supplies around the world. And frankly, the reason that we're not seeing an impact in the U.S. is that the export terminals were full in January before Strait closure, and they're full now. So we're just exporting, right? Someone's taking advantage of that huge discrepancy, but it's not like we can respond and push more gas out of the country to make up for the lost volumes in the Strait. So we're still pooling gas back in the United States. We had more or less a normal winter. On a normal winter, we took inventories down. That tells me that we're in a structural deficit in gas prices, right? If you have normal weather and inventories stay flat, seasonally adjusted, that would tell me we're balanced. If you have normal weather and they build, that tells me you're in surplus. And if you have normal weather and they draw, it tells me you're in deficit. So I think we're in deficit. We had a normal winter and inventories went from well above average back down to average. They're still not at dangerously low levels by any stretch of the imagination, but we've worked off a lot of that overhang. And I think the path forward, it's going to continue to be one, I think, of convergence between the U.S. price and global price, which could be, you know, multiples of where we see it today. This has been a very frustrating trade for us. It's taken a lot longer, mostly subject to weather disappointments, and then a little bit to, you know, some stubborn production that's taken a bit longer to slow and roll over than we would have expected. But still, you're not seeing, like, you know, fabulous growth anywhere outside of the Permian because of the reasons that we just talked about. So to answer your question, or what are they thinking, and are they adding up the numbers? I think the short answer is no, they're not. And before you call, I'm not saying you, before one calls anybody, you know, names and say, how could they be so foolish? You know, you have to appreciate the huge magnitude of what the shales did in gas. In many ways, the disruption to the U.S. gas market from shale gas was far greater than shale oil. We brought on, you know, 95 plus billion cubic feet per day of new gas from shale. Divide that by 6, and that's your oil equivalent. You're talking 18-ish million barrels and 16 million barrels of oil equivalent, far in excess of what we brought on the actual oil side. And, you know, we threw the kitchen sink at this thing. You know, we converted a lot of our coal plants to gas. We built all this petrochemical industry. We built a huge export business. We laid down already a lot of data centers and fertilizer plants, and we've still been able to produce more than we've needed. So on some level, I suppose I can empathize with the developer, whether it's a data center developer, a pipeline developer, what have you, that kind of says, look, I think the gas, we have it in hand, but maybe I'm being too kind, because it ultimately is a really, really big blind spot. When you talk to these guys, no, they don't care. I mean, that's the short answer. They say, we worry about a lot of things, we don't worry about the gas. Go to Europe. It's a totally different story. It's a totally different story. Everyone's worried about the gas because, you know, first they had their disrupted supplies from Russia. They had to go to the LNG market to buy it. Now a bunch of the LNG in the world is tied up in the Strait of Hormuz. So Asia's bidding that desperately away. And, you know, finding molecules of energy in Europe is challenging, and you feel it. When you talk to the people, they feel it. We in America tend to be focused at the prices, about the price at the pump. You know, I think very much the American psyche is tied around that gasoline price, and they don't have any idea what natural gas costs. And I don't think that will last for very long.
Now, when I look at the EIA's projections, they merrily show us going from, I'm rounding here, about 100 BCF up to 150 by 2050. Where's that gas coming from in their minds?
Look, again, I just don't see it, because if you look at shale gas fields, we're going to take away the ones that are growing, but let's just look at the bulk of them in numbers. You know, most of them have peaked and rolled over and done so quite violently. The Barnett is down 50%, the Fayetteville down 60% or so, the Marcellus down, now peaked for 3 years. Some people say it just needs more pipelines. But, you know, we added a big pipeline last year. We didn't get a huge upsurge in volumes. It's, again, sort of just flat through that. So I think it's making this big prolonged kind of top before it, too, begins to roll over. You know, will it come from the Utica? People have been trying at the Utica for a while now. Do they get results? Yeah, there's some results. But when you start to lose really prolific fields and you backfill them with more challenging fields, that's never the recipe for new highs. You need to get a new field that is on par with the Marcellus and the Permian to replace the Marcellus and the Permian if you want to start to see any material growth. And again, just like the shale oil, I don't see where that will come from. There's some opportunities in Canada. And look, you know, I debated Doomberg, who's an energy analyst on Substack, a couple years ago, and you know, it was more of a semantic fight, honestly, than it was a true intellectual debate, because, you know, at a certain point he said, well, you know, in 10 years' time, do you think we're going to consume more oil or less? And trying to say, do you think the world economy will be greater or smaller? I think it'll be greater. I think we'll consume more, which, of course, means we have to be producing more. So, you know, this is not sort of a Malthusian call that we're running out of everything and we're going to have to sort of shut the lights off. What it means is that easily dispatched unit of marginal growth becomes harder and harder to find, and that's what resets prices higher. So where will it come from? You know, I'm sure your viewers and listeners will post in their comments a list of fields that it will come from. I'm sure it will. My point is, we're going from an era of abundance driven by a huge capital boom 10 years prior in the shales that brought on the abundance that led to low prices, that led to a dearth of capital or a lack of capital, which is now having a supply response. That's the commodity cycle. And I think we're in the process of inflecting towards a major bull move.
Understood. And just to really clarify this for people, when we say the Permian, it's actually three formations in the Permian that we're down to: the Wolfcamp, the Bone Spring, and the Spraberry. All others are just that little blue smear at the top. Really, the Wolfcamp's doing the heavy lifting on this whole thing. So, again, you know, some people look at this and say, wow, look at all that gas growth. We'll just keep growing that forever. But what you said before is this is actually indicative of a shale play that's starting to bubble out.
I think that's right. And you know, it's very funny, because a number of years ago, Pioneer Natural Resources, which was a big Permian producer later acquired by Exxon, they had a single quarter where their gas to oil ratio went up. And I was astonished at how many people came out of the woodwork talking about bubble points and gas oil ratios and retrograde condensate. And we really thought it was a fairly esoteric, you know, in the weeds kind of technical thing. Everybody became consumed with that, and they used it as an excuse to sell off their Pioneer or go actively short. And of course, that kind of worked itself out. This is years ago. The field was not depleting yet. And we wrote at the time, I said, I don't think this is a problem, because the field's not depleting and the GOR issues you should expect to see them down the line. So that was sort of a false start, you know, for the bubble point people. And we never thought that that was a issue then, but I think it is now. I think it is because if you look at the, again, the total recoverable reserves, the way we estimate them, which is a bit of an art and a bit of a science, we're much farther along clearly in the life of that play, by definition, I guess every day or day older, but I think you can make a, we can make anyway, a very credible claim that you are now at a point in time that you should expect to see a bubbling out, as you put it. And sure enough, you're seeing that. So again, that's not the sign of a healthy young field in growth. What it really is it's sort of, you know, the swan song. It's the, you know, your old granny getting a burst of energy sort of right before she croaks, not to be too crude.
And the wild card for me in this is the data centers, because it's just all anecdotes. I mean, I have to pull individual reports. I can't find anybody who's aggregating this at either the state or national levels.
I agree.
So I read about a big data center in Texas and one in Illinois. So I start mentally adding them up. But with that one Microsoft one I mentioned at 0.75%, if you had 100 of those, you're consuming 75%, right? So obviously we're not going to have 100 data centers of that magnitude, but there are thousands of data centers going in, which are largely take the natural gas, whether they burn it themselves or they tap into an electric grid that's burning it. They're making a demand call on natural gas.
Oh, absolutely. No two ways about it. And, you know, a lot of these tech companies are talking about nuclear to power their data centers, but that's not going to be until the 2030s. And so to the extent that they want to have growth now, which they all, of course, do, there you need gas to bridge it, or coal. Coal could do it, too. I don't think there's a big appetite for that. I think certainly you would prefer to burn the gas that seems to be today readily available, abundant, and cheap, right, and clean. It's not going to be renewables. It cannot be, for a variety of reasons we probably don't have time to get into here. But it will be natural gas will be the huge beneficiary. And like you said, it's either going to be off the grid or behind the meter, which means, you know, co-located on site. Completely irrelevant from a gas perspective, whether you go through a regulated utility, you know, gas molecule as it's being burned and spinning a CCGT turbine doesn't care if it's behind the meter or in front of the meter one bit. And so, yeah, it's a massive, massive number. Now, to your point, nobody knows where any of this stuff is going to settle out. And I wouldn't, you know, necessarily want to make a gas bet predicated only on data centers, but you don't have to. You know, the market is relatively tight today. Again, inventories have come down. They're not at dangerous levels, but relative to averages, they've come way, way down on fairly normal weather. Prices sold off, by the way. You had that chart up before about a 12-month period. They sold off because it had a very mild end of February, March, very, very mild and benign. Cold enough that air conditioning demand didn't kick in, and warm enough that heating demand wasn't necessary. It was quite a lovely period, but, you know, not great for gas demand. And so, of course, weather will always remain the wild card. But on normal weather, I think you just keep tightening this market. You keep tightening it. You keep tightening it. And it is probably on a percent move, you know, from here, right, with gas sub $3, could it get to 10? It's going to get to 10 before oil gets to 300, I think. That's for sure.
Well, I'm going to continue to watch the flat production like a hawk, because if it stays flat, I'm just going to be like, well, it's staying flat for some reasons. And the reason is probably because we're not producing more. And is that just a shortage of drill rigs, takeaway capacity, or is it that things are rolling over and the gains out of the Permian are no longer keeping pace with the losses from other areas? Don't know. But I see a setup here that's exceedingly bullish when we look at all the calls on demand.
I do as well. And sorry, just one thing that I'll say just quickly, you know, it's hard sometimes for people and myself and anybody to think in terms of exponential decays and differential equations. And that's really what you're working on here, because you have a well that comes on, that well begins to decay exponentially almost at once. Then you have every well comes on is a little bit less productive than the one that came on before it. You have wells that are getting older, so getting gassier, but getting less productive in general. And so it's all these kind of opposing forces all operating in exponential space, not in linear space. And it's really hard to kind of wrap your head around it. But it turns out it's actually quite straightforward to model on on Excel or on a computer program. And what it suggests is that you're getting awfully close to this period where gas supply in general will stop growing and demand is just going gangbusters. It's just going gangbusters. And so, yeah, that sets up for the market that we love to get involved in, one that's been completely starved of capital, one that has a narrative, a bearish narrative embedded in it. In this case, I would say it's best summed up by the Doomberg adage of sort of we have an unlimited amount of gas. And on the way up, unlimited growth feels like it's unlimited as it's growing. It's not until it stops growing that it feels awfully difficult to come by. And when you can find areas like that, starved for capital, based around a bearish narrative that's ultimately incorrect, and the fundamentals are about to turn, I mean, if you can just really lean into that, you can make a huge amount there's a huge amount of value. And that's what we try our best to focus on. And sometimes the calls can be stubborn, but usually over the long term, they can be very, very fruitful.
And that's exceedingly well said. And so what I'd like to do is take the macro perspective of this, which you did in your most recent quarterly report about the Straits Closed. And you had a really interesting analysis that I had to read twice. I might have read it three times, honestly, because I wanted to understand it, being a commodities investor. So you said, well, this is typically how a commodities chart looks. And you can take a ratio of the commodity total return, say, set against the Dow Jones industrial average. You can do it against the S&P. But you're saying stocks versus commodities, where are we? And the normal way to look at this is that there's times when commodities are undervalued because they've dipped below this one line, and sometimes they're overvalued when you get to this four. But then I'd like you to walk us through this sort of insight and recalculation that y'all came up with, which is, I guess, sort of contained in this chart, and I have the next one too.
Sure. And this is for the real kind of, wonks out there and math nerds, because this is not for the faint of heart. And it's a piece of analysis that I find quite interesting, but one that by the time we're all said and done with this conversation, you're going to end up right back at the beginning at the same conclusion we reached from the old chart. So you have to bear with me, and hopefully some of you might find it somewhat interesting. So in general, we have been using this commodity ratio. If you go back one slide that you showed there where you said, there you go. That's what I would call, the chart that we became a little bit famous for over the years. And, we've been fairly open in saying we stole it. We stole it from Jeffrey Grunblack at Double Line, and he showed it to 1970. And it was simply the Goldman Sachs Commodity Total Return Index divided by the Dow. And we wanted to see it going back farther than that. And so we built our own Goldman Sachs Commodity Total Return Index proxy using the underlying commodity prices. And we took it all the way back. And we got this chart, which was very actionable. There's times where they're cheap, times where they're expensive. Every time that it's expensive has been ushered in a bear market. Every time it's cheap, it's ushered in a bull market. So that's quite helpful and handy. But something kind of always nagged at us, which was, you're using this commodity total return index, and you're using the price level on the Dow. Now, everyone said, why don't you use commodity spot prices and the price level on the Dow, or total return, or we've had people suggest every which way. The commodity total return index is also a bit tricky because it incorporates a fully cash collateralized, there's a interest rate element to it, and there's a roll yield element to it as well, which frankly makes your head spin by the time you have it all figured out. But it had a nice advantage that it was actionable. And that's how kind of everyone that we had seen starting in the 1970s looked at it fine. Now, one of the problems is if you take the price of a barrel of oil or of any commodity, but let's say the spot price of a barrel of oil, that is a price level. And over time, right, it should rise with inflation, let's say. It should rise with, the general kind of cost of living, because a nominal dollar is not a nominal dollar. But that's it. If the market were always in equilibrium and easily supplied, it should settle around its long-term extraction price adjusted for inflation. Stocks, on the other hand, so that's your numerator. Stocks, on the other hand, the thing that you are dividing that commodity price by, well, that's going to grow by two things. It's going to grow by inflation and GDP growth, right? Because the stock market grows and compounds on itself. So you should expect that a company is going to earn a certain amount and they're going to reinvest some of that back in their business. And with that, they're going to grow and expand. And so over time, not only will the stock price of that or the equity value in whole, let's say, of that company go up by inflation, it'll go up by some function of inflation and GDP growth. So if you have something in a perfect equilibrium, which I know we're not in, right? But in a perfect equilibrium, the oil price will go up by inflation divided by the stock market, which goes up by inflation plus GDP growth. The inflations cancel out, and that ratio should fall by 1 over GDP growth. And if you go to the next chart, that's exactly what that shows. Over time, there you have a relationship, which is spot commodities divided by the price level of the S&P 500. And you can see, in fact, it does decline. That's the line of best fit. And it's awfully close to the long-term estimates for real GDP growth. And we thought that was super, super fascinating. You know, that's the true underlying mechanism in a commodity, long-term commodity progression. It's not that commodities versus stocks should go in this band like this perfectly over time. It's that actually it should decay exponentially by 1 over real GDP growth. And if you look back 150 years, sure enough, it does. But the other thing that jumps out at you is that there's periods of time where it's far above that trend line and other periods where it's far below that trend line. So you can take it one step further and say, yeah, even though this is an exponentially decaying relationship over time by 1 over real GDP, remember I told you this was going to be dry, you can... You know, first what you can do is you can take the exponential decay out by taking the logarithm of that. And then you can see it follows this very, very nice downward path where you can put a middle point, a high point, and an end point, a low point. And if you subtract that, so you kind of, you know, essentially rotate it, normalize it, what you're left with is a chart that's very similar to our first chart, which is essentially.
Oh, I only got to there.
Oh, okay, fine. Well, what happens here basically, you know, so here if you take the green line and you subtract the red dashed line in the middle, you end up where it normalizes across zero. It's not this downward sloping thing. If you're saying how much above and below trend line are you? And what you can see right now is that we're as far below trend line as we've ever been. And you can see the moments here where broaches the low end of that long-term channel are again 29, 69, 99, and today, and the high ends are 1919, 1945, 1980, and 2011, exactly the same as the first chart does. So you have all the predictive ability. It's showing you a very similar predictive power like the other original chart does. However, I think what we're doing now is we're actually capturing the true mechanism that's at work here, which is to say spot commodities versus spot stocks should decline over time by 1 over real GDP growth. Subtract that out and see where you are within that decaying band. And you are cheap now on commodities relative to equities as we've ever been. It suggests that money's flowed out of commodities and productive capacity and into stocks and bonds to a certain extent as well. And I just think that with this sort of new way of understanding, what it does is it provides a little more theory behind it. It provides a little bit more of a philosophical underpinning as to why that happens, whereas originally it was a little bit more of an observation. Look, here it is. It moves in this band, and you should buy it when it's at the lows. Now I think we understand it perhaps a little bit better. It's really this hidden exponentially decaying relationship. So like I said, a little bit dry, gets you back to the same place, but ultimately a very worthwhile exercise and I think quite important to understand the commodity markets.
Well, it didn't give us a totally different answer, so that there's that. I'm wondering, and this we could save this for a future conversation, but when you mentioned copper, and so my experience with copper is that the deposits are getting smaller, more dilute, more difficult to prosecute, which has an exponential increase in energy costs or extractive costs and all of that. Certainly that whole period of time where you're calculating that, I think we had generally abundant access to minerals, but now there is some areas, certain areas, where we're going, oh, this could be problematic. Copper, looking forward, obviously some problems in production compared to demand looking forward. So does scarcity begin to factor in at this, you know, looking forward or not?
I think it does. You know, you're absolutely right that deposits are getting more difficult to find. And I think that deeper, more difficult, bigger permitting headaches and issues, like you said, lower grades, et cetera. You know, on the other hand, and, you know, lots of people tout this as a commodity bearish driver, and I never really agree with them. But over the really long term, I do agree that, you know, technology does help here. Technology, both in exploration, new ways of developing, new ways of mining much more selectively than you did in the past, et cetera. So I think that, yes, we have a huge, huge headwind in new resource development because a lot of the easy to discover stuff has already been brought to market. Will that ultimately lead us to be unable to grow supply? No, I don't think so. I think it will mean that things are more expensive. I think it'll mean that more capital needs to be deployed. But I think eventually, after years and years and years of a bull market and huge returns accruing to equity, investor interest will be so peaked that money will come in. And even if it's these lousy, disparate projects all over the world, money will come in because prices will go up until too much money has come in and we've built out so many of these lousy, tiny projects that we end up in a bear market anyway. So I think the commodity market is destined to move in cycles. I don't think that geological constraints mean that we're going to enter into a period where it's up and to the right forever. Eventually, too much capital will chase it, like most other things. But we haven't even started. So I think that will be the challenge. We'll be overcoming some of these geological constraints and the fact that we've developed a lot of our easy-to-discover mines. Wall Street will figure it out eventually.
Well, good. Everyone, we've been talking with Adam Rosenzweig of Gehring and Rosenzweig. Go to GoRosen, GoRozen.com. to find their quarterly missives. They are must-reads. I never miss them. They're thoughtful and thought-provoking. And so, Adam, thank you so much for your time today. Is there anything else you would like to direct people to?
No, I think that's it. You know, I think just to reiterate, I think we're in the early stages here of a bull market. Out of all the commodities people talk about, we get asked, do we miss it, et cetera, you know, three commodities made new nominal highs. One made a new real high, and that's gold. The other 46 are still below their past nominal peaks and well below their real peaks. So, look, you know, flows of funds into the industry have been anemic. Even in gold, frankly, has been anemic into gold miners. But I think that we are very early days across most commodities here. Maybe with the exception of gold, I think that could trade sideways for a while. But most of the other ones look awfully bullish to us. And I think there's going to be a huge, huge opportunity for investors that decide to make their moves now.
Excellent. Well, Adam, thanks again. Really appreciate your time and knowledge on all of this.
Thank you.